Stuart Mason, who lectures in adult education in UCC. And he has a different perspective, a different story about the value of psychiatric diagnosis, or the value of labeling. And Stuart will write the book.
Oh, yeah.
When I say value of labelling here, I mean it both positively and negatively, so I'm going to go through some examples of the way that I've been labelled. Right, can you... Bit more forward? Is that all right? Okay, so my name's Stuart Nielsen. I used to be a mathematician and a health statistician. And about 14 years ago, I went through some harassment and bullying at work that ended up with me being entered into the psychiatric system. I spent about 10 years in limbo with various diagnoses of PTSD and anxiety, depression, OCD, psychosis, so a whole load of different things. And then at some point, I was given the diagnosis of Asperger syndrome. And since then, a lot of things have changed for me that... I went off and did a diploma in disability studies, which I enjoyed greatly. I learned a lot about looking at health from the perspective of the person who's being described rather than the statistical dimension of just looking at numbers and counting people up and giving them labels and putting them in boxes. And now I've been involved in the development of a new course on autism spectrum studies at UCC. So I teach and I write, so I'm in the position of actually defining labels, not just being labeled by other people. Sorry, I pressed the button there. And labeling starts, whether you like it or not, people label you. And it starts from birth. The very first question when the baby comes out is, what is it? And some incorrect answers are 3.5 kilos, or healthy, or it's Stuart. No, they're not the right answer. The right answer is it's a boy or it's a girl, because that's the first thing that you're labelled with. And then you're labelled with ethnicity, and you're labelled with age, and you're labelled with height, and you're labelled with whether you're like or unlike the person who's labelling you. You're put into the same box, or you're put outside the box. And some people are a little bit different. They have things that people notice as being oddities, and they're outside every box. All the time you spend your life, for me certainly, going through being this feeling of exclusion. And some of it I know is in my own head, that I see maybe somebody has an expression that looks like anger or dislike. And it might just be that they have indigestion. But my mind processes that to say, they're reacting to me. I'm being excluded. I'm being disliked. And I find that difficult going shopping. I find it difficult in a classroom. I find it difficult in all kinds of settings. I always feel this kind of anxiety that people dislike and exclude me. And that's the way that my mind works. And I've come to accept that, and it helps to know. I've got some examples here of my first experience of being medically labelled. I went to the school nurse with abdominal pain. And I was sent off to see the doctor. And when I came back, I had this little slip of paper. And on the slip of paper, it said some things about, you know, a 13-year-old boy was presenting with abdominal pain. And in the middle of it, it said RIP. And I asked the school nurse, what does RIP stand for? And she immediately, very quickly, came up with right intercephalic pain. No, it's there, beside your phallus. Right into phallic pain. She'd made that up, obviously, on the spot. Very quick-thinking nurse. But it was RIP, like, he's making it up. He's a hypochondriac. Rest in peace. So these kind of things were quite common on medical notes until the Freedom of Information Act. And once the Freedom of Information Act came out, you couldn't put on a child's note, funny-looking kid, FLK. You couldn't put NFN for somebody who's a bit odd, which was normal for Norfolk. And then During the course of my psychiatric treatment, presumably everybody knows, you don't actually see a psychiatrist, you see a registrar, you see somebody very junior, and you see a different person every single time. When I go for my appointments, there are 40 of us in the room, and we all have an appointment at the same time, and we're just queued through, and we're seen by whoever's in the building. And they could be students, for all I know. I see them once, and they've got this 1.5-inch thick dossier on my life, and somebody wrote on the top of it, N-A-N-C. I didn't know what that meant, but I'd been to one of these meetings, a consultation with the psychiatrist, and I had an examination. The consultation was at 2, the examination was at 4, and I told the receptionist, I'll have to leave in order to get my examination at 4 o'clock. And 4 o'clock came and I hadn't been seen, so I went back to the receptionist and said, I'm leaving. So I left. And they wrote N-A, non-attender. And they also wrote beside it N-C, non-compliant. And it was there for 2 years. So for 2 years, every time I saw one of these new registrars who didn't know me, they'd look at this thing on the front cover, N-A, N-C, and say, this is a difficult, useless person who doesn't attend and they don't take their medication. So it changed the nature of the treatment that I had, because nobody went beyond the front page. They'd look at the front page and they'd look at the last page and say, these are the drugs you're on, shall we increase the dose, was the typical day of seeing a psychiatrist. And throughout my life I've had social labels to do with being different, of not being the way that other people are, not being, I'm not interested in sports. I don't care what grown men do with their balls. So I don't fit into the normal conversation that men have. I'm not down the pub drinking pints and things. And the kind of labels I had at school were freak and weirdo, because I liked study. I liked mathematics. I really enjoy getting into problem solving. And that's abnormal for a teenage child. So I was called these things. I was also called Egghead and Boffin and Mr. Bean from the character on TV. Because I didn't pursue the normal manly things that teenage boys are supposed to do, I was also called queer and homo. More recently, I've been called pervert and pedo, because they're quite strong things that people say. If I walk home from teaching on a Thursday night and I pass all the bars in Cork, there are these men outside drinking, typically young men. And they spot any kind of minute difference in the passers-by, and if they feel like saying something, they just shout out, pervert and pedo, for no reason other than their own entertainment. And they're very, very quick to notice the differences, but they're very slow to find anything more imaginative than sexuality or ethnicity. And if I answer anyone, I don't answer them now, and they notice that my accent isn't local, they say, go back to your own country. No, you're not allowed to question people. And this is maybe for people who are visiting. You might not have heard this term, a non-national, a human being who is a non-national. And from Wikipedia has a nice definition here. It's a term used to describe a person who's not from Ireland, though they might have Irish citizenship. It regularly features in the media when discussing people from outside Ireland. So this term is about not being in any box. And you can't actually go back to your own country, because there's no name for the country that you should go back to. You have no label for the thing that you are. So then I became a psychiatric patient. I had these diagnoses of anxiety, depression, paranoid, traits of OCD, signs of psychosis. So I got drug treatment for all of them. And being a reader and being interested in mathematics, I found that the drugs that I was treated with took away the ability to read. They took away the ability to calculate. They took away everything that I did for work and for pleasure, and I spent about 10 years in that process of being treated with progressively higher doses, and maybe the next one's going to work. And I was called treatment-resistant and I was called refractive depression, and I was called difficult, and I was called all kinds of other things as they went through all of these varieties of drugs and raised the doses and took them away and replaced them with something else and amplified them with a different medication for nighttime. And you get the triple whammy of the antipsychotic, the antidepressant, and the anti-anxiety medication before bed, because it guarantees you'll at least be in the bed until 8 o'clock in the morning when you get dragged out for breakfast. And I was told I was sabotaging my own recovery, that I was not trying, and that I didn't want to get better, because obviously the drugs weren't working. It must be my fault. And psychiatry, typically, the way I experienced it, is psychiatry blames the patient for failure. All the way through, you're being told it's your fault that the drugs are not working. It's your fault that you're not the right kind of depression. You're not the right kind of responder to the treatments that we have. And any other medical discipline, if you went in with some kind of abdominal pain or whatever, they would look for a better label and a more meaningful intervention. And people like I have persistent abdominal pains end up with this diagnosis of IBS. And you can control that. You take ownership of that diagnosis of IBS, the irritable bowel syndrome. And you decide to change your diet, change your lifestyle. You might take antispasmodic drugs. But it's something that people with IBS take control of. It's their label. They use it for the way that they want to alter their lifestyle. So then, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome. And if you notice that I don't capitalize the S, the capital is given in the name of Asperger to recognize the fact that he named it. And it's not a possessive. There's no apostrophe S at the end of his name. It's not his disorder. It's not Asperger's syndrome. It's Asperger syndrome, named in honor of. It's ours. No, we take ownership. We take it away from this person and say it's Asperger syndrome. And the traits of ASD are in deficits. They're described in the DSM as deficits and impairments in three major areas of social interaction, which in my case I'm perceived to be by others a loner. I'm perceived to be aloof, snobbish, arrogant, emotionally cold. There's that word on the front of my bench there saying reserved. So that too. Deficits in social communication. Being pedantic in the language that I use. Talking out of turn. If I'm in a conversation, I interrupt other people. I have my interest, and I've got to pursue my interest until my interest is finished. So I'm seen to be talking out of turn and not listening to other people and insisting that they listen to me. I've got very poor taste in humour, and there's somebody I've been to dinner with who's laughing there because she knows that. When you're eating, all five of your senses are engaged. No, when you eat, you smell, you taste, you feel, you hear, all of your senses are engaged. And there's only one other occasion when all five senses are engaged for most people, and that's during sex. So when you're eating, it's natural to talk about sex. And it's also natural when you're eating to talk about the other end. You know, if you enjoy food so much, if food is such a big part of your life, why not talk about the other end of it, the digestion? And so it was a very poor judgment. And the third one, it's called social imagination in the DSM. And it also, it's called restricted and repetitive behaviours. Being obsessive, having rigid thinking patterns, not liking to change thinking unless there's really good evidence. It leads a lot of people into the STEM, the science, technology, engineering, mathematics disciplines. And having fixed routines and being upset by change, but upset to the point that actually if somebody changes my routine, if somebody visits the house unexpectedly, if I have an appointment cancelled, I actually feel like the world is going to end. And I actually feel like ending my own life. You know, something I have tried to do. That's why I ended up in psychiatric care in the first place. So that anxiety of change is a very, very strong thing. It's not like most people would feel. I don't like having my calendar rearranged. This is a very deep thing. When I was diagnosed, I was given some leaflets that actually weren't terribly helpful. But I was given this wonderful paper by Punch and Skiroff and Murphy called The Not Guilty Verdict, Psychological Reactions to a Diagnosis of Asperger's Syndrome in Adulthood. And in this paper, the people who were interviewed, they talked about the way they'd gone through their life feeling like they were excluded of being a loner, of being different, and then trying to explore why they felt like that, as maybe sexuality, that maybe they were gay, maybe they were mentally ill, maybe they had a serious illness. And then suddenly they're presented with this diagnosis and they say, I'm actually not guilty of all of those things. I'm not guilty of being the person who's at fault. It's actually something, it's part of my neurology, it's part of the way I am. And these people who've been interviewed in this paper had come to terms with it as being a not guilty verdict. And instead, they're an autistic person or a person with autism, and you could argue about whether you want to put autistic first, make a political statement about it, or say you're a person and you have autism and not make the political statement. And along with that, you decide you're disabled. I did disability studies, and obviously the social model is a big thing in disability studies, so you're no longer a medical label. You're a person, and you're a person who happens to have a set of impairments. And those impairments change your life, but they don't end your life. You don't end up outside the system. And disability is the process where society decides to exclude people on the basis of their impairment, because it's expensive to make ramps. It's expensive to put hearing systems in, or expensive to have a signer. It's expensive to have somebody who's got anxiety that changes the way they shop. You can't make one-to-one shopping for the sake of the few people who do have that level of anxiety. But disability is all about politics and a rights-based perspective on the effect that impairment has on you and the effect that the impairment has when you're outside your own home. And in autism, there's a big community who have developed this word, neurodiversity. And Judy Singer, who is one of the people credited with inventing this, said that she had gone from a thing with no name to a new way of being, that she'd gone from something that had no name to something that she had a name that she was in control of, neurodiversity. And they say, this group of people, that neurodiversity encompasses everything from autism through to so-called normality. There's a spectrum. Everybody's a part of that spectrum. Everybody's got some elements of neurodiversity. And in the DSM-5, there was a huge argument last year and the year before about taking out the label Asperger's syndrome. I don't think it actually does any harm to say that it's actually autism and encompass everybody with autism, because politically it's more inclusive to do that and to call it autism. The diagnosis I have happens to be Asperger's syndrome, but it doesn't bother me if somebody says it's autism. So then, being disabled, you'd look at me maybe and say that I'm not disabled, but in the DSM it says that the symptoms of Asperger's syndrome or autism cause clinically significant impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of current functioning. And in my case, spending 10 years going in and out of psychiatric hospitals, I would say is a clinically significant impairment. And the legal system in Ireland happens to agree with that. So the kind of bullying and harassment that I had that led to being hospitalised, that led to my breakdown, is something that I now know I've got some protection against. If I say I'm actually a disabled person, I can insist that an employer accommodates me. I can insist that the benefit system accommodates me. Mostly, people are either in work or out of work claiming unemployment benefits. And there's no middle ground for most people. You can't claim benefits and work. For me, I'm not able to work full time. But through the benefit system, through being disabled, through accepting that label, I'm able to work and to take some measure of benefits, and the benefits decline in proportion to working. So it's something that if I work, it costs the state less. It's something that they're able to do for me. Looking at the literature, I mean, I teach, so I collect lots of papers. These are papers that I've come across in my teaching. The medical profession doesn't talk about us in very nice ways. We've seen some already. And one of the things that we're talked about is being a burden. And this one, the burden of mental disorders in Victoria, 1996. So mentally ill people, people with disabilities, people who have autism, are perceived to be a burden on the state, perceived to be a burden on society. They cause trouble. Psychopathology in adolescent and young adult criminal offenders. There's this very strong link in public perception between crime and danger and mental illness, that the two are perceived to be the same thing. In fact, most mentally ill people hide away from society, and they're far less likely to be involved in crime than people who don't have mental illness. Callous, unemotional traits is a cross disorder construct. One of the things that people say about autism is that there is a deficit in empathy, and empathy falls into two categories of affective empathy, where you can feel things in the same way as other people feel, and cognitive empathy, the ability to recognize that somebody else is feeling an emotion. If I walk into a shop, I see the expressions on people's faces, and I can't judge them. I can't see cognitively the way that somebody's feeling. So I'm not able to feel the same thing they are. I can't reflect their emotion. So people see me as being emotionally cold or distant. But that doesn't mean the same feelings don't exist inside me. I have those feelings. I'm aware of them. I also get confused between bladder and bowel function and emotion. I feel that I'm uncomfortable, and sometimes I suddenly realize that I actually need to go to the toilet. And that discomfort and that anxiety goes just by taking away that biological pressure. You know, I perceive it as an emotion because I'm not good at discriminating between different emotions. And this is perceived to be callous. Now, that's the way the literature describes it. And sufferer, I've read this in the newspapers about myself. I read it about all autistic people, that they are sufferers. I don't suffer from autism. I do suffer from anxiety. I do suffer from social exclusion, but I don't suffer from autism. So I'm not an autism sufferer. Some people do. Autism can be so severe that it is suffering. It causes suffering. And I've got some examples here from newspapers. One of them is the former Barcelona striker Romario described his former teammate Messi as saying he suffers from Asperger syndrome, a mild form of autism that allows him to concentrate and focus more than most people. Messi's affliction has shown the same traits as seen in Albert Einstein and Isaac Newton, and have all been positive in a footballing sense, and has brought a lot of joy to the fans. So how's he suffering if he's got an affliction that allows him to focus and allows him to bring pleasure to his fans? That's not suffering. The second one, many parents are unaware that their child suffers from autism. Are they aware that the child is suffering? And if so, what is it that the child's suffering from? It's probably not autism that they're suffering from if you're not aware that it's autism. But if it is autism, maybe it's better to have a label to put on it where you can get some appropriate intervention. And then the third one, my favourite, this is from the Metropolitan Police, from a community newsletter that they put out. The man, aged 27, suffered with a fixation for flashing blue lights, and he would buy a new SIM card or use the local payphone to summon the emergency service vehicles. Now, how is that man suffering from his obsession? He picks up the phone and his obsession comes to him. Now, he's suffering from the fact that other people interfere with it. And he's also suffering from the fact that they haven't found a better intervention that allows him to enjoy his obsession and his fixation without causing distress or harm or potential danger to other people. Why don't they invite him to the fire station? That's something that the fire station does every week. It has public open days. He could go there and look at the flashing blue lights, and it wouldn't cost him or anyone else a penny. My buttons aren't working here. Okay, right. So this is from the film Snow Cake in 2006. And the girl there is called Vivian, and her mother has autism. And Vivian is aware that her mother has a fascination with sparklies. These are the rubber balls. And when you bang them, the light-emitting diodes flash inside and it plays a tune. And she knows her mother loves this. So she buys a big carrier bag full of them at a petrol station. And the man who's driving her, who's in the bottom right-hand corner of that set of images, has no idea. Why would you buy them for a grown-up woman? What could they possibly mean to her? And she takes this bag of things and bangs it on the dashboard and sticks her face in the carrier bag and looks at these lights, because she's grown up with her mother's obsessions. She can understand what's in her mother's mind. And she can enjoy it in the way that her mother enjoys it. And even when the character Alex arrives at Linda's house and presents her with the sparkly and sees the effect it has on her face, the way her face lights up when she sees sparklies, you got me sparklies, he still doesn't understand what it could possibly mean to her. And by the last scene in the film, it's actually clear that he's spent some time with her and he's seen how different she is and what she gets pleasure from, and he's come to some understanding of how to give her a sense of pleasure. So self-identification, where you take a label and you decide what the label is. In the UK census, I mean, my background is statistics, so I love the census every 10 years. They count all the people in the country. They ask for every single adult and child to be listed, and all kinds of things to be listed about them, like disabilities and where they go to school and what religion they are and what ethnicity they are. And this question, ethnicity, is the most contentious question. They used to ask the head of household to tick off on a list of kind of black and white, and everybody else in the household would have the same ethnicity as the head of household. And it's got progressively more fine-grained as people take ownership of the census and say, you're not looking at us, you've got to measure what we are. And two of the things that they say the census should do is that they should reflect their own choice of how they view their own ethnicity. And the second bit is that the thing that people pick is from the list of options presented to them. So the first consideration is straightforward. The ethnic group that each person chooses is intrinsically the ethnic group of self-identity, rather than the one that's been ascribed by the census enumerator, the person who comes to your house and helps you fill in the form or checks you filled it in correctly. But the second consideration is not so clear-cut. You have to pick an option from the list. And the ethnic group options are presented to the respondent by the state. The state's drawn up that list. Like the DSM has been drawn up to describe mental illness, a group of faceless people in an office somewhere on the far side of the world have sat down in a committee and drawn up a list of things that you've got to pick from. And a census enumerator I had a conversation with was talking about this lovely white British woman who filled in the British census. And when she got to the ethnicity part of the 1991 census, she crossed out the whole section. And the enumerator said, why have you crossed out the ethnicity section? And she said, I'm not ethnic. It's like, I've got my box and ethnic is not in it. So if you throw out labelling, you throw out all of that. Now, taking ownership of labelling is very different from taking the label that's been applied to you. And in the Irish census, you can be white Irish and you can be a white Irish traveller and you can be any other white background. You can't be a black traveller. It's not there in the census. You can't tick that box. You can be black Irish. You can be black African and you can be other kinds of black, but you can't be Chinese black. You can't be Chinese Irish and you can't be Asian Irish. because that's the way the form's being constructed. So you'd have to decide, you're going to other yourself, you're going to put yourself in the excluded box by ticking number 8. You know, any other, write in description. And all of the 8s will be there in this category of all the odd people. All the eccentrics are going to be there together. And they do the same thing with religion, but ethnicity is the one that's the most contentious. And I'm coming close to the end of... Am I getting close to the end of my time? Yeah. So I had a conversation with the psychiatrist who saw me recently, and he was talking about how they'd formed groups of diagnostic categories. So when there are appointments to see the psychiatrist for a consultation, they would have people of similar diagnoses in the waiting room at the same time. And they found that the waiting room was calmer, the consultations were calmer, and that people started to socialize because they were more alike the people in the waiting room with them, rather than the way it had been before, where whoever made an appointment was there sitting next to whoever else had made an appointment. Now there were people who shared something in common. They had this diagnosis in common, or a category of diagnoses. And I said to him, isn't that wonderful that you've actually got something that's changed the way you practice? And he said, yes, but the drugs are just the same. Now, whatever you are, the drugs are just the same. And that list there, I went through a couple of nights ago. I keep all of the drug information leaflets that come out of my prescriptions. That's a list of things that psychiatrists have given me over the last 14 years. So I've gone from one antidepressant to another. I've gone from one antipsychotic to another. And then when I was given this diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, they took away almost all of this medication. And now I can think, I can write, I can calculate, I can do statistics. I can do the things that I love doing. And this idea of taking ownership is ancient. And this is the Gutenberg Bible. Gutenberg, Johannes Gutenberg, he created his printing press, he created his business, not for the purpose of necessarily spreading religion, but to make the Bible affordable. His one aim in life was to allow each person to own their own copy of what he thought was the most important book in the world. The DSM is, I looked it up last night, $199.95. We can't own our own copies unless we feel like forking that out. The International Classification of Disease is on the internet. Now, it could be on the internet for everybody to own it, but it's not. It's expensive. It's not in the public library. The DSM is not in the public library. Why not? It's in university libraries. It's in the library here. But ordinary members of the public who have been given a diagnosis can't go and look at the descriptions and the differential diagnoses and the traits and whatever's in there. It's not a public document. Ideally, you have to be a member of the American Psychiatric Association to own a copy, and it's cheaper if you are. But in Genesis, God said, let's make man in our own image, after our own likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the fowl of the air, and over the cattle and all the earth. How did God do that? So in chapter 2 of Genesis, he says, out of the ground the Lord formed all of the beasts of the fields, the fowl of the air, and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called every living creature, that was its name. That was Adam's dominion. He was allowed to name the things that he was going to have dominion over. And I'd like to conclude with another census enumerator called Roderick Hunt. And Roderick Hunt wrote a letter to the London Times in 2011 saying, Sir, as a census enumerator in the 1981 census, we received in my area this response to question 12, occupation. The reply was, I am a sculptor of lions. To the next question, please describe the nature of the work done. The respondent replied, I chip away all the bits that are not lion. So thanks very much for listening.